Hello there. Welcome back to In the Shadows of Utopia. Just to start off, I want to extend so much gratitude to the people who have contacted me or left a review on iTunes. Really helps and it means a lot to me as well. Second, if you are interested in getting in touch or checking out some of the supplementary material to the podcast, you can go to our website at www.shadowsofutopia.com. There I've got some handy maps, photos and paintings, which will help you visualize some of the content in the podcast even better. So if you've listened to the last episode, which is sort of a prologue or like an introduction, you'll remember me saying that we needed to explain this story from the beginning. That story, of course, being an explanation of the revolutionary period in Cambodia, which began in 1975. To fully render the events of the 1970s, the crimes of the Khmer Rouge, and more importantly, why these crimes against humanity took place, we need to explore Cambodia's ancient cultural heritage. How it came to be that Cambodia was in the position it was in the modern era. It's like World War II. You can't just start the story in 1939. You need to talk about the Great Depression, the Treaty of Versailles, the World War I, maybe even Otto von Bismarck. To get a complete picture of these events, you must be prepared to start these explanations a fair bit in the past. In relation to Democratic Kampuchea, which was the name the Communist Party adopted for Cambodia once gaining power in 1975, we need to go back a ways, about 1500 years or so. If we are going to explain why these terrible events occurred, we may very well end up following a similar narrative path that's been forged over years and years of literature written about Cambodia. This grand arc of history from Angkor Wat to the infamous killing fields outside of Phnom Penh is a visually and narratively engaging way of telling this story. But just because it is commonly told through these two points in history, does not mean it is not a valid version of this story. In fact, it seems to me that it is probably the most common way that people visiting Cambodia today will encounter this history. Depending on whether you fly into Phnom Penh or Siem Reap, these are the two biggest tourist destinations in the country, you will either see the story of Cambodia on an upward trajectory into a glorious antiquity, or a downward one into what can really only be described as one of the worst, most inhumane disasters of the 20th century. Arguably the two most famous destinations in Cambodia, the high school turned torture facility known as S21, or its accompanying mass grave known commonly as the killing fields of Chong Ek. You have this seemingly bottomless pit of suffering that was inflicted on the entire nation within the nation's current capital city. And on the other hand, the other star you use for navigation in this country, this other portal into the more distant past, is the absolute zenith of this nation's cultural heritage. Its biggest, most beautiful achievement, one of the so-called wonders of the world, the glorious temple of Angkor Wat, which lies outside of the other place you might start your journey, Siem Reap. Between these two marks on the historical map, the visitor to Cambodia marvels at the highs and lows of this beautiful country. Naturally, there are many ways one could explain this story. I could tell you about Cambodia in relation to what happened during the Vietnam War, for example. But that wouldn't give you the whole story. We need to see the whole picture here, before Angkor, after the killing fields, and everything in between. What follows will be part one of a two-part episode, an introduction into Cambodian history and into the period historians call the Golden Age of Angkor. I want you to be able to understand the fundamentals of this period of history, before we then, in part two, deal with the decline of this civilization, before the colonial period begins. I'm not starting this story at Angkor just for the sake of it either. Cambodia's cultural heritage is a complex subject, but its glorious past was of huge importance to the people who designed Democratic Kampuchea, the stage of this modern tragedy in which millions of innocent people will lose their lives. For instance, in 1977, 2 years after the Khmer Rouge had taken control of Cambodia, their leader, Pol Pot, proclaimed in a speech that if our people could build Angkor Wat, they can do anything. Another party leader, Khieu Sampan, said that the Khmer Rouge victory in 1975 was the best thing that had happened in over 2,000 years of Cambodian history. He said that winning the war over the imperialists was even more splendid than the Angkorian era, more splendid than the brilliant Angkor Temple. The Khmer Rouge, outwardly iconoclastic and interested in wiping clean the slate of the nation to build a utopian vision upon, well, they still decided to put Angkor Wat on the center of their flag. This was one tradition that they deigned not to break ties with the previous imperialist regime on. The national anthem of Democratic Kampuchea also makes reference to Cambodia's Angkorian kings. One verse reads, "Long live the dazzling victory of 17th of April 1975, more glorious, more meaningful than the Angkor era." Pol Pot would even reference rice harvests of this ancient empire as a sort of goal that could be matched or even surpassed by his regime. Cambodia then, and today, is almost synonymous with the temples of Angkor. So part one of this series will be explaining to you just why that is. Okay, so what are these leaders of Democratic Kampuchea referencing when they invoke the Angkorian era or Angkor Wat? What am I talking about when I say Angkor, or even Khmer? Well, it's important to get a working definition going here, even of these most basic terms, as the early portions of this series really are wading into things, assuming you, my dear listener, might not know anything about Cambodia. But slowly, we will acclimatise to this body of knowledge, and by the time we get back to the events of the introductory episode, the evacuations of Phnom Penh, well, you'll be an expert. Alright, so first things first. When people say Angkor, they can mean a few different things. They could be referencing the Angkor Empire, a large kingdom that spanned across the Southeast Asian mainland about 1,000 years ago. You could also call this civilization the Khmer Empire, as the Khmer, the word that people of the dominant ethnic group in Cambodia used to refer to themselves, were the people who controlled this empire. And they did so from a capital city near the Great Lake of Cambodia, a region that we also call Angkor, which means city or capital. So you could kind of relate that to, you know, Rome as an empire and also a city. Or how you might use the word Washington to infer the seat of power in the United States. Angkor is also the word we still use to describe the area near Siem Reap in modern-day Cambodia, the area you might visit on holiday and explore. So it is a word that has a lot of uses, and its meaning can vary depending on the context. It should also not be confused with the word Angkor, which is the word that the Khmer Rouge used to describe their own communist party, and literally translates to the organization. On that note, as we said, Khmer, generally speaking, means Cambodian. So when we say Khmer Rouge, the name that Prince Sihanouk gave to those communists in his country in the 60s, we've got the French word for red, rouge, so red Khmer, communist Cambodians. And just to wrap this up slightly, it should also be remembered that the capital city of the Khmer Empire also had, you know, a name, Yasodharapura. Angkor is an easier way to refer to this area today, however, and a shorthand to how it functioned in the past. Okay, now you might be familiar with this area from its famous temples that still remain there today, seen in just about anything that's associated with Cambodia, and the most famous of these temples, the one probably in the best condition and perhaps the most exquisitely constructed, is Angkor Wat. Wat meaning temple, Angkor meaning capital city, voila, the temple of the capital. So, going forward, when I say Khmer Empire, I'm generally referring to the period where the Khmer were dominant across a vast region. When I say Angkor, I'm generally referring to the city as it functioned as the capital of that great empire. But if I were talking about it in a modern context, I would be referring to how the city still functions today as an important cultural landmark for Cambodia. Historians generally split Cambodian history up into four or five distinct eras over the last 2,000 years or so. The first is called the Funan period, which lasts from about 100 AD through to about 600 AD, which then leads into the Chanla period, with a bit of overlap running through until about 802 AD, which is when the Angkor era begins, and runs through until 1431 AD. So that 600-year period, which, as we will see, doesn't really relate to the beginning and end of the Khmer civilization at all, generally highlights what was the golden age of Angkor, the Khmer's period of so-called greatness, where they had this large empire, the biggest city of the pre-industrial era. They built all of this wonderful architecture that we still value today. That's what those dates kind of highlight. If we are comparing this 600 or so years to what is going on elsewhere across the globe in, say, Western Europe, it's kind of the Viking Age into, you know, the period of kings and castles, the Middle Ages, figures like William Wallace, Joan of Arc, if that helps you contextualize this. Whereas somewhere like Japan, well, that was the Heian period into the Kamakura. You might say ancient Cambodia, but Angkor is more of a Middle Ages kind of deal, particularly at its height, when we are talking about events taking place about 700 years ago. Now, as we are placing this in time, perhaps you might like to place this in space. If you like, you can use some of the materials on the website to contextualize this as well. Maps of the region, of Angkor, of Cambodia, are all there if you'd like to use them. But essentially, we're talking about Southeast Asia. In particular, the area between China and India that we can use this helpful but somewhat antiquated term to describe, Indochina. Now, it's actually going to be handy for me to refer to the area in question as Indochina as a kind of shorthand for this area on the map, rather than describing the people within it. Like, there's no Indo-Chinese people. There are a variety of ethnic groups, countries, and cultures across this space. But later, some portion of them will become colonized by the French, namely Laos, Vietnam, and Cambodia, and that will be referred to as French Indochina. But the term Indochina generally has a use as it helps us place the mix of cultures here as well as this kind of fault line between the two vast civilizations of China and India. The people who live here can be seen to have been influenced from both of these cultural giants. For example, Cambodia, which I should also say contains a multitude of ethnic groups, but the majority are Khmer, so for simplicity I will use the term somewhat interchangeably. Well, they have more of a cultural influence from the Indian side of the fault line, whereas the Vietnamese, and again we could make the same point about the complexity of using that phrase to describe everyone that lives there, again, lots of different ethnicities, but generally speaking, the Vietnamese have more of a cultural influence from the Chinese side of that cultural fault line. So when I say cultural influence, what am I talking about there? Well, scholars actually refer to a process known as Indianization, which occurred in the region of Cambodia in these early periods of its history. It might be helpful to mention here that in the ancient past, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to refer to India existing in any relation to the way that the modern nation-state of India exists, just like Cambodia didn't exist in a modern sense 1,000 years ago. For simplicity's sake, we're just going to refer to that region as India and the cultural influence on Cambodia as Indian, even though that western part is sort of a conglomeration of kingdoms that were never really unified as a state called India for a long time. But regardless of that, the most glaring example of this process of Indianization, and perhaps one of the most important for the establishment of the Angkorian civilization, is that of religion. Both Hinduism and Buddhism spread from India into the region of Cambodia in that first era of history that I referred to earlier as the Funan period. This was roughly 1500 years ago. The spread of these religions is facilitated by the fact that both of them are quite flexible faiths, and they could, you know, intermingle with the indigenous animism or ancestor worship present in Cambodia at that time, and still today. Scholars maintain that it was Indians from the West that brought these cultural artifacts and religious sort of ideas and other influential aspects of statecraft, such as administration, to the Funanese. Naturally, they brought their writing system, Sanskrit, as well as other functions of the state at that time, like astronomical study and other Hindu conceptions of cosmology. Historians have pieced together ideas of Funan being a sort of trading kingdom with quite a large economy, but it would be a stretch to assume that this was one unified polity. After all, we refer to the kingdom in this region and at this time as Funan, but that's just because of what it's called in Chinese documents from this era. Historians and archaeologists have quite scant evidence to go off when constructing a picture of this earliest period in Cambodian history. It may be more prudent to see this period as characterized by a sort of loose assembly of independent communities and kingdoms, sometimes at war, sometimes at peace, that are trading with the larger kingdoms around them. What I would like you to understand from this kingdom we are calling Funan, however, and this lasts until about 600 AD, is that there is a growing constitution of people there who have their own culture and indigenous beliefs, but have been heavily influenced by the larger neighbouring kingdoms of the Indian subcontinent. The important distinction is that they were not actually one in the same. For instance, the caste system associated with Indian society was not adopted by these early Khmer. It could almost be explained in terms of, like, modern operating systems for your computer. Let's say the operating system for the Indian subcontinent is, like, Windows 98. But the one that would be adopted in the region of Cambodia is, like, Windows 7. I don't remember if that was a good one or not. Maybe it had the tiles or something. I don't know. The point I'm trying to make is that if you were used to one of these operating systems, it wouldn't be very difficult to get to grips with the other one. They share most of the fundamental similarities, you know, like a start button, a file explorer, Word. However, in substance and aesthetics, they are quite different systems and cultures. Like I said, scholars don't have a real wealth of evidence and sources to inform their picture of the early kingdoms of Funan. And the one that succeeded it in the 6th century, known as Chenla, well, the story is not that different there. We have scant evidence to base our assumptions on. For instance, Chenla, like Funan, is the word we're using to refer to these areas, but that is not what the people there would have referred to themselves as. This is, again, just working off of Chinese sources from that time period. It seems that Chenla may have been a former regional centre of Funan with, like, an unknown degree of sovereignty, which then became the dominant state in the region for a few hundred years. There is significant disagreement in the literature about just what the origin, extent, and even where the capital of this kingdom was. And just like Funan, whether this can even be considered to be one single kingdom. Some scholars will even assume that these designations of Funan or Chenla are just a simple way of referring to these loose conglomerations of small polities which traded with others. It's only through this trade with China that we can gather any of the evidence for this time period. So as you can tell, without much evidence to go on, there doesn't seem to me to be too much relevance to our story in regards to these, you know, early periods of Cambodian history. But what I would like you to take away from both the Funan and Chenla periods is a few things. First of all, that there was a system of state management that borrowed significantly from the Indian subcontinent. This involved cultural aspects as well. These systems were further developed in the Chenla period as well as the system by which rulers gained power. Kings in this period were often chosen on their prowess in battle, and this shifted away from this merit-based system to a more sort of patrilineal style. You know, like the son of the king is the next king kind of system that you'd be fairly familiar with. This process of kingship and Indianization resulted in a further consolidation of the Hindu religion in the area that would become Cambodia. Aspiring kings in Funan or Chenla found this Hindu system of hierarchy and state power useful because it offered a royal ideology, but it had no political strings attached. What I mean by that is that by identifying themselves with Hindu gods such as Shiva or Vishnu, the kings of this period could command a great amount of power, but they would not be expected to carry out any kind of mandate for the people they ruled. In further cementing these Hindu religious icons, temples became an important part of the kingdom as centres for taxation as well as worship. Common people would be involved in the upkeep of these temples, and were also expected to donate land, goods, slaves, even sometimes children, to these religious foundations. These temples almost functioned like little corporations in their own right, but they also allowed the king to expand his power and attract more and more civilians who followed the Hindu belief system. One last thing I want to get across about these two early eras of Cambodian history is that the people we are talking about living here are almost certainly ethnic Khmer. Archaeologists and historians see little change in cultural aesthetics or language between each era leading into the Angkor period. So what this means is that there have been a consistent sort of culture, language, and people in the region of Cambodia for at least 2,000 years. People speaking Khmer, doing Khmer things, and just generally, you know, being Khmer. This feature will become more important later when we are discussing this, like, fate of a whole people, or the national history of the Khmer in relation to its neighbours. But for now, let's just simplify this by stating that the people who live in Cambodia today have been living there for a very long time. Okay, so we've established that there were two different, largely distinct periods in this early history of Cambodia so far, lasting about 700 years or so. But between these two distinct periods, the people living in this territory were of the same ethnicity. They shared the same language, culture, but we've not been able to say with any real conviction that there was a unified kingdom here, or that the people living here would have even referred to themselves as one single Khmer population. Maybe even the idea of being Khmer wasn't actually solidified. But around the year 800 AD, we may start to see this quite disjointed and contested history start to become a little bit clearer and unified. We start to see the recognition in the area of Cambodia of a single Cambodian people and a unification of the people living there. The period which we call the Angkor era can be seen to originate in around 790 AD in the career of the first god king of Angkor. From an inscription written in 1050, which is like 200 or so years after the events it describes, I might add, we learn about the monarch known as Jayavarman II. This is the guy generally credited with kickstarting the Angkor Empire. So who is this guy? Well, from what we can gather, the young Jayavarman was an ambitious prince who set about freeing his kingdom, the one that we are tentatively referring to as Chenla, even though it wasn't a unified kingdom, from the dominance of a foreign power, an Indonesian kingdom which we refer to as the kingdoms of Java. So if you have that map handy, or that generous mental image I created for you, and we pop Cambodia on the coast of Southeast Asia, then south of that, across that sea there, modern-day Malaysia, Indonesia, back then that was dominated by the kingdom of Java, or the Sriwijaya. There seems to be some evidence that Jayavarman may have spent some time in this kingdom, because once he gathers support from the separate communities and kingdoms of Chenla, you know, doing some battles, gathering political friends, kind of like a presidential campaign today, but with less lying and more sword fights, the bulk of this would have been forming alliances with locally powerful people who were willing to transfer some of their allegiance to someone claiming to be a universal monarch. In exchange, you would probably get more land and power in return from this king. So, Jayavarman has this really special ceremony once he gets enough support to declare independence from Java. This ceremony, which he holds at Phnom Kulen, a smallish range of hills visible in the distance from where Angkor sits today, well, he has this elaborate ritual there involving the Hindu priesthood. Basically, having gathered up enough support from the smaller groups and territories across the region, he declared not only religious and political liberation of these peoples, but he also kind of claimed himself to be their ruler. To really solidify his case here, he also has this ritual confirm his status not just as king, but a god king, a Devaraja, a divine, universal ruler. He had himself transformed into a manifestation of Vishnu, breaking tradition with previous kings who had simply claimed a kind of patron-client relationship with the Hindu gods. Jayavarman wasn't anointed by the gods, he literally was one. Now, I'm not sure if historians have 100% nailed down the history of Jayavarman II, and it is not my area of expertise when it comes to Cambodian history. But it seems that this ritual may have been imported from the Javanese, which might explain why it was kind of special and original that Jayavarman had done it in Cambodia for the first time. Now, whether Jayavarman was the main instigator of this kind of consolidation of the people around the region of Cambodia into a more unified kingdom, whether he merely capitalized on forces that were already in motion, that's hard to say. But we can see evidence that around this time, the area itself begins to be known as Kamboja Desa. We can more easily differentiate the people living in this area from the surrounding kingdoms. And who knows, perhaps the people living there were also becoming more aware of their own culture as distinct from others. While historians might find it hard to get real answers to some of these questions, we can certainly see some kind of influence from Jayavarman II in the record itself. Whether it was down to him or not, there seems to be a kind of welding together of disparate groups into a more unified, self-aware community. And subsequent rulers of this community will look at this cult of the Devaraja and continue it. They will try and incorporate him into their kinds of ancestor worship and treat him as if he were the beginning of their political culture. So because they tend to revere him so much, as well as continue his legacy in building their cities around the same area as him in the region of the Great Lake, the Tonle Sap, as well as the kinds of trends that are solidified in the aftermath of his declaration as a universal monarch, we use that date of his inauguration, 802 AD, as the beginning of the Angkor era. So in any overview of this part of Cambodian history, we're going to have to hit a few key notes. Jayavarman II and the start of the Angkor period is certainly one of them. Now, as this is part one of two episodes discussing the rise and fall of Angkor, I want to park the bus about 100 or so years after the beginning of this period, and before the end of this episode, explain to you some of the main building blocks of this civilization, which would come to dominate the entire region for the next 500 years or so. So let's pick this story up with the actions of the king Yasovarman I. Historians regard him as an important king for a few reasons. Firstly, he established a new capital city for the Khmer Kingdom, named Yasodharapura, at the site which we refer to as Angkor today. So, in other words, he built the city that would become the seat of the great empire. In this city, he built the first large temple pyramids, notably the beautiful temple that sits atop one of the central hills in this region. The temple is called Phnom Bekeng. Now, to the east of this temple, he also built a vast reservoir of water that measures like 6.5 kilometers long and about 3 kilometers wide, or about 4 by 2 miles. Now, the interplay between these three facets of his rule and the astonishing amount of manpower that he would have had to wield in order to build them is the reason I want to end part one on the rule and building projects of Yasovarman. For me, he sets the stage for the true zenith of the Angkor period, which we're going to pick up on in part two. Alright, starting with Phnom Bekang, the temple pyramid he built on top of the central hill of Angkor. This temple, like many of those built before and after in the region, is a symbolic representation of the mythical home of the gods and center of the universe in Hindu mythology, known as Mount Meru. These temple pyramids are an attempt to build something cosmic in the human realm. These temples usually housed a statue, which was associated with the god which the king was supposed to be a manifestation of, usually Shiva. Shiva is the Hindu god, one of these paradoxical kind of deities in Hindu mythology, associated with both the creation and destruction of the universe. Shiva is also associated with erotic love, which is best exemplified in the symbolic representation he is usually presented in, a statue known as a linga, which basically looks like a penis. So, the temple pyramid, unlike the more famous Egyptian ones, is split into square or rectangular levels. In the case of Phnom Bekang, the temple sits on a rectangular base and rises 5 levels, and it is crowned with a series of towers at the top. The temple at Phnom Bekang is not only representative of the home of the gods, but also references the axis of the globe, the 4 lunar phases, as well as the 12-year cycle of Jupiter through the night sky. It is a beautiful temple, as well as an astronomical calendar, which speaks to the prowess of this king, as well as the burgeoning technical mastery of the Khmer Empire during this early phase. Phnom Bekang is a personal favourite of mine, and when you stand on top of this period, it's really not hard to imagine what was, you know, going through the mind of Yasovarman as he stood atop this temple mountain, looking around at the plains of his city and thinking to himself, yep, this is all mine. This is a real king of the hill kind of moment, and you can experience it as well. I should also mention that if you are actually thinking of visiting Angkor in Cambodia, you can get a great view of the sunrise and skip the like million tourists that congregate at the more popular sunrise location at Angkor Wat. You just have to trek up the hill before the sun comes up, which can be fun in regards to like spiderwebs, but it really is worth getting this amazing view of the plains of Angkor with the mist and the sun peeking out behind the hills. It's very peaceful in comparison to Angkor Wat, which is just a mess of people. And you can even see it sort of poking out from the trees to the southwest when you're standing atop Phnom Bekang. Anyway, that's just a little side note for you that, I don't know, maybe you're in the region right now listening to this. And if so, I hope you enjoy yourself. Now, 1,000 years ago, someone standing atop this mountain and looking to the east would have been able to marvel at another one of the hugely important aspects of construction that Yasovarman undertook. A massive hand-dug reservoir of water that I referred to earlier. Now, this massive artificial lake is known as the East Baray. The East Baray also plays a role in Indian symbolism, wherein lakes surround this mythical mountain, home of the gods. But apart from looking cool and making you look good in front of the gods, these vast reservoirs of water and the canals that connect them were of huge significance to the prosperity of the entire Khmer Empire. Okay, now because this relationship between water, land, rice, and power is going to be so fundamental to much of the discussion we have about Cambodian history, I really want to nail this in. And I'm not going to do this really again throughout the series, but I'm going to make you remember this by using a Simpsons quote. Without context, here it is.
Sugar. Thieves everywhere. The strong must protect the sweet. The sweet.
Elmer?
In America, first you get the sugar, then you get the power, then you get the women.
Homer!
Solid advice. Now, we can also imagine Yasovarman, and indeed many of the great kings of Angkor, having a similar sort of version of Homer's rationale there. This version might go something along the lines of, in Cambodia, first you build the lakes, then you catch the water, then you get the rice, and then you get the power. Now, you might say to yourself, that was a pretty stupid way to sandwich a 20-year-old Simpsons quote into this historical podcast, and I agree with you, but it does get to the heart of one of the more interesting and impressive and important aspects of the Angkorian era, this mastery of the water. So when talking about Angkor, we really need to talk about the weather. If you've spent any time in Southeast Asia, I don't know, maybe you live there, you'll be keenly aware that there are basically two seasons in that part of the world. You've essentially got the wet one and the dry one. This is pretty important stuff if you're, I don't know, considering building a city or maybe a civilization and you want it to last for like 1,000 years. Most of the classic examples of ancient civilizations are built up around water. It's the most basic building block of agriculture, which is in turn one of the most basic building blocks of a thriving society. Everyone needs food, everyone needs water. The two, you know, they go hand in hand. Now, in the case of Cambodia, that wet and dry season are extremely noticeable. Between May and November, the plains of Cambodia, which is a very flat country, get inundated with about 1.5 meters of rain, or like 3.5 feet. That's about 90% of the entire annual rainfall. Let that sink in for a second. Half of the year, you are basically swimming about in the rain, and the other half, you've got basically nothing. Not only is it not raining, but it's hot. It's hovering around 40 degrees Celsius, which is more than 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, I'm no farmer, but even to me it seems pretty obvious that it might be hard to get some solid crops going when you've got A, no rain, and B, it's like 1,000,000 degrees for half of the year. This is made all the more harder when the main crop, the very thing that builds the foundation of your entire civilization, economy, and prosperity, rice, is basically grown underwater. If you think about that dynamic between the people, the land, and the rain, just think about that for a bit. Something becomes quite clear. Essentially, you've got 6 months of the year to grow all the rice you can, so that when it gets dry and hot, you've still got food to eat until the next monsoon starts. Very quickly, you would begin to notice that if you don't do a very good job in the wet season, then you won't have enough in the dry. And, well, that's just not going to be great. You're not going to have a good time. And if that happens to a bunch of people in your society, well, that's a recipe for famine and starvation. Maybe on a civilization-sized scale. Naturally, if you're a farmer in this kind of society, like a subsistence farmer, you are going to be pretty into farming. You're going to care a whole lot about water, and I think it's safe to assume that you are going to make sure that you don't screw around when it's time to get that crop started. Rice is not an easy thing to grow either. It requires a lot of attention and fine-tuning. It also needs to spend a significant time underwater to grow properly. So you can see this quite intense relationship between the people, the water, and the land they grow their crops on. It's life and death for a subsistence farmer. You're not going to be a casual or part-time farmer. This is a full-time gig. It's probably safe to assume that even if you or I are put in this scenario, you might get a little bit superstitious as well when it comes to your farming. I mean, if your family might starve, I'm going to be maybe less inclined to atheism if my whole life depends on the weather. You can see the role of gods or deities, which tie into this process, playing a large role in people's lives. This is where, you know, a god king is going to get a lot of their credibility when ruling as well. If you tie yourself into that cycle, Well, maybe you make it kind of clear that you're fairly important to that process of the monsoon coming. You're going to have a lot more support that way, aren't you? Building these massive reservoirs of water was hugely important for kings, as it served a couple of vital purposes. First, you ensure that you have heaps of water for your people to use for their farming, and when it's hot they can also have a dip, which is, you know, it's cool. Second, with all these people able to farm all the time, you're going to end up doubling, in some cases tripling or quadrupling, the amount of rice you can harvest in a year. With all that extra food, you can maybe get more people to stop farming and maybe to build some temples for you, or roads, or maybe they can join your army, thereby spreading your boundaries of rule and getting more people to join in on this process of building, farming, and expansion. So if you follow my logic here, you see the beginnings of a civilization who became masters of the water around them. The Khmer were given the choice to either subsist on what nature had given them, or to literally terraform the entire area and become masters of the land and water. This mastery of the elements allowed their entire civilization to prosper, and led to the city of Angkor becoming the largest pre-industrial city in the world. It is thought that this city maintained more than 1 million people at its height. It was built around these canals of water connecting these reservoirs to rivers and lakes. You can imagine this infrastructure in the same way as the roads or train lines function in our modern day cities. I mean, it's pretty hard to imagine a city being built today, or continuing to exist, without this complex system of roads and train lines. If we look back at Angkor, we see evidence that the huge amounts of limestone and sandstone used to build these beautiful and huge pyramids was actually floated down river on these canals into the city where they could be used for construction. On a more basic level, I mean, you can imagine people rather than hopping in their, you know, car to get to a friend's house, simply popping in their, you know, canoe and sort of paddling down the road. These massive advancements in hydraulic engineering, as well as the sheer manpower used to build this staggering amount of infrastructure, can still be seen today. The West Barai, built around 100 years after Yasovarman had completed the Eastern one, still holds the record for the largest hand-dug reservoir on the planet. It still holds like 20,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of water, and it's still used by the locals around Siem Reap. It is these kinds of hugely impressive cultural monuments that helped to inspire the Khmer Rouge regime to wipe Cambodia's slate clean and utilize an antiquated form of agrarianism to build their new utopia in the 1970s. But perhaps more impressive than these hydraulic systems that were utilized in Angkor is the technical mastery required to build the world's largest religious monument, the truly beautiful wonder of the world, Angkor Wat. The construction of this temple and the golden age of the Angkor period, as well as its decline, will be the subject of part 2 of this introduction to Cambodian history, and I look forward to sharing it with you. I want to thank you so much for listening, and indeed waiting for this episode to come out. I will endeavour to have the next episode out in a much shorter time period than it took this one. Again, I would ask that if you enjoyed this episode to please support the show by leaving a rating or a review on iTunes or wherever you may listen to this podcast. Or perhaps you could share this podcast with friends or on your own blog or website. And if you have the time, please check out www.shadowsofutopia.com for more information about the podcast, further reading about Cambodia, or more information about me. I'm your host, Lachlan Peters, and until next time, goodbye.